Good morning and welcome to the November 19th, 2018 edition of Mountain Money. I'm Roger Goldman. I'm here with my co-host, Doug Wells. Good morning, Doug.
Good morning.
We have a great show this morning. Our first guest this morning will be Alan Dunn. Alan is the former Assistant Secretary of Commerce in the Bush administrations, whose responsibilities included international trade. As President Trump prepares to meet with Chinese President Xi Jinping at the G20, we're going to get a better understanding of what is going on with international trade in the Trump administration and how things might go from here.
And then we're going to go from a national topic to more of a local topic. We've got Greg Elder. He is the Vice President of Retail for L.L. Bean. As all of us know, they've got a new location on 670 Main Street, and we're going to hear from Greg L.L. Bean's plans and just a little bit more about the company. They've got a long heritage, and I'm going to be interested to hear that conversation. And then our last guest is Toby Stranger. He is the senior money writer for Consumer Reports. Consumer Reports has recently published an article on holiday deals, and are you really getting the bargain that you think you do, and some things to look out for. You're listening to Mountain Money on this cold but sunny November morning. Stay tuned to KPCW. We'll be back in a moment.
Hello, this is Reese DeMille with Republic Services, your local recycling and garbage pickup provider and a proud sponsor of KPCW's This Green Earth. Garbage and recycling containers should be placed at the curb before 7 a.m. on your scheduled collection day. Keep Summit County green. SummitCounty.org/recycle.
This is Brooks Harbertson, commercial lender for Mountain West Bank, sponsor of the amazing programming on KPCW. At Mountain West Bank, we offer consumer loan options as well as home loans and business loans in one location. Mountain West Bank, just off Kearns, next to the theaters. MountainWestBank.com, division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. A prominent feature of Donald Trump's 2016 campaign was his promise to fix what he labeled as China's longtime abuse of the broken international system and broken trade practices. Indeed, during a presidential debate, Trump labeled NAFTA the worst trade deal ever. And since taking office, the president has continued to pursue an aggressive trade policy, imposing a range of new tariffs on Chinese goods and renegotiating certain elements of NAFTA. These policies have some immediate effects. Soybean sales from U.S. farmers have plummeted. And last week, Ford claimed that it had lost $1 billion in profits and was preparing for mass layoffs as a result of recently imposed tariffs on steel and other goods. International trade is an extremely complex issue and one that is really hard for most of us to understand. What exactly does the U.S. believe that China and other countries were doing wrong? What is the objective of the current strategy of imposing large tariffs on Chinese goods, and how could it play out? Who really pays tariffs? And how do you think that conversation between President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping is likely to go at the G20 later this week? Fortunately for us, we have a guest who actually understands this stuff and is in an excellent position to help us understand how we got here and how things might go in the future. Our first guest this morning is Alan Dunn, former Assistant Secretary of Commerce, whose responsibilities included administration of U.S. trade remedy laws. Alan was a key figure in negotiating a number of agreements, including the GATT-Uruguay round, which established the World Trade Organization, and NAFTA. Alan, welcome to Mountain Money.
Thank you very much, Roger. It's a pleasure to join you.
Let's start by setting a framework. We call something trade remedy laws. What are trade remedy laws, and how do they regulate international trade, if they do at all?
Well, under the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade, we set international trading rules that are subject to some variable interpretations, but pretty well understood. And if you engage in practices, trade practices, that are violative of those rules, then there's a right under the World Trade Organization regime to impose tariffs to offset the violation with a remedy. And some of those are like anti-dumping laws, where you try to offset the amount of dumping, or countervailing duty laws, where you try to offset the level of subsidy. Other more complex ones are like the Section 301 sort of general unfair trade cases, which is what we see in the case of China, one of the ones that we see in the case of China, or the National Security Clause investigations that have become very popular in the Trump administration.
And there's clearly unfair trade practices that are taking place throughout the world by multiple countries, right? And so the question is, what do you do about it? One of the remedies is tariffs. Now, in the United States, when we impose a tariff on a country, on a product of theirs, talk to us about how that tariff actually gets paid. Because if you listen to President Trump, it seems like the country that he is imposing the tariff on pays that penalty, that price. Is that the case, or how do tariffs get paid?
Well, yeah, remember old Papa Joe Kennedy used to say, perception is everything. And I think that that's a part of what President Trump's trying to do when he describes these things. The people who actually pay the tariffs are the end consumers of the goods that are moving. So in the case of, let's say, someone buying a foreign automobile in the United States, they're the one paying ultimately all the tariffs, even on the components or the metals that went into making those components. It isn't some foreign country unless it's a state purchaser as the end user.
But so, let me just break it down. So aluminum comes over. It gets imported from China. There's a tariff on aluminum. Who writes the check to the U.S. Treasury saying, okay, there's $100,000 owed in tariffs? Ultimately, it's going to get passed down to the consumer. But who writes that check?
The importer of record, technical term of art. It's the person who signs those papers when it enters the customs territory of the United States.
Let's take a step back and do the big picture of what we think the Chinese were doing wrong. What is it that we feel were the unfair trade practices that have sort of gotten us to where we are today?
So there's three basic types of problems that we've seen with China. One is they've kept their market essentially closed or limited opening to the United States products. And when we do try to come in with products, what they'll do is sort of, second thing, try to learn how we make it, steal that intellectual property, if you will, sometimes very aggressively and, you know, under our laws at least, what would be very illegally. And third, they impose a really, really high tariff on the goods that we actually do get in. So there's frictions. That's what tariffs are. It's basically a friction on trade, and they put the brakes on.
Let's break it down a little bit. And the intellectual property problem, can you give us some kind of examples of what we're really talking about there? What kinds
real
of
life examples?
Exactly.
Yeah, well, let's take a big industrial one, glass. The U.S. and the Europeans are both very, very advanced in making plate glass, automobile windshield glass, fancy types of glass to very high specifications. The Chinese were not so good at it. So there was a lot of glass being sold into China, both by the United States and Europe. Well, the Chinese said, come on over and build a plant here if you want to continue selling. And then they started learning how it was made, made identical plants surreptitiously. With the same workers who'd been trained in the Saint-Gobain, the PPG factories that had moved to China. In the end, the Chinese stole the market entirely and forced the Europeans and the Americans out.
Yeah, so that's a great example of the buyer ultimately has the power in these situations, right? Why was China able to do that? Obviously, companies like PPG knew that it was a risk. Excuse me. That their technology could and ultimately would be stolen. So the buyer has the power. As you look at the trade situation now, you know, the U.S. is by far the largest importer of all these goods and services. How does that help the U.S. in this current trade tariff skirmish or war?
So, well, President Trump is right on one thing. We do have a lot of leverage because we are the largest importer in the world. We have the biggest, most frictionless market in the world here, much less friction within our market than the European market or the EU market, which is, well, larger, much more complicated to move goods around in. So everybody wants to be here, and in that case, we're the buyer with leverage. We're the United States. China, on the other hand, offers a great big huge market. So if you're doing great here in the U.S. and you'd like to grow, how about serving those billion-plus people? So that's what gives them the buyers leverage in that case.
So we talked about the intellectual property issue. What were the other things that were creating? Let's give some examples of other issues that were creating friction that led to this sort of tariff standoff that we're in now.
Well, there's the fairly frequent practice of damaging goods as they come in or losing them. So if, for example, you're trying to import a car into China, an awful lot of those cars slip off the dock. They just sort of...
Sounds like New Jersey.
You have a product loss cost that's so high that it means it's difficult to actually make money doing that. For a long time, when we were trying to send cars into Japan back in the 70s and 80s, they would insist upon taking the entire car apart to inspect every part for every single car.
That would get old.
So those are the kind of things that are really irritating to people who are trying to penetrate a market to begin with.
If you're just joining us this morning, our guest is Alan Dunn. He's the former Assistant Secretary of Commerce under the Bush administration. His responsibilities included international trade, and we're talking about the U.S.'s trade tariff strategy. Alan, I want to ask you, is it wise of President Trump to be taking on so many trade adversaries at once, or would he more likely have succeeded by targeting one country at a time?
A lot of people have second-guessed him on trying to take on so much simultaneously. Opening up the possibility of a trade war with Europe and China simultaneously, while you're also withdrawing from the trade partnership of the Pacific, what was going to be the largest free trade agreement in the world, that seemed like a big armful to try and grab all at once. There's a strategy, subjective strategy call there to make, but I think that it's proving to be a very heavy lift.
Let's break them down one at a time then. With respect to the Chinese strategy, what exactly are we trying to do? What specifically has President Trump tried to do, and how could it play out?
A lot of China's economic success is going to be based upon their ability to sell to the United States. So the Trump administration, the entire cabinet, is focused on trying to use that leverage to get the Chinese to stop stealing intellectual property. By the way, the Europeans are just as upset at them as we are on this, but we have more leverage, and they're happy to slipstream behind the U.S. effort to curtail that type of intellectual property theft. The tools that the U.S. are using are pretty blunt tools. Tariffs are blunt tools. The National Security Clause investigations are not just blunt, but they have the risk of hurting the United States downstream if it goes badly.
So I take it the president has imposed new tariffs on aluminum and uranium and other metals and other goods. And how have the Chinese responded?
Well, the Chinese have recognized that they did get into a problem of overcapacity. They overbuilt, like most big communist societies. Someone says, what we need is an aluminum industry or a steel industry or whatever, and they just turn on the burners and they make way too much of the stuff. So that's kind of what happened with aluminum. That's exactly what happened with aluminum. It's arguably what happened with steel, and it's arguably what happened with uranium, although that wasn't a Chinese problem as much as a Russian and Kazakh.
So that's China. What about, at least tangentially on the surface, what looks to be a victory for President Trump, which is that renegotiating NAFTA, we now have the USMCA agreement. What's your sense on that? How important of a change is the UMC agreement versus NAFTA?
It made some important changes in narrow areas. I was one of the lead negotiators of the worst agreement in the history of mankind. So I'm sensitive to what he said, but the reality is that it changed about 5% of the NAFTA. And it changed it, as I say, in important ways, but only about 5%. So, trying to look at this objectively, I'd say he took an agreement that was maybe an A- and turned it into an A, or an A and turned it into an A+, if you believe that we can actually get a trade agreement that good. It's mostly about dispute settlement issues as opposed to real tariff issues, with the exception of the origin rules on autos. And that is the biggest single trade among Canada, Mexico, and the United States. So for the auto people, this is a pretty good win. Okay. The U.S. automakers, the NAFTA, was a pretty good win. The renegotiation I'm talking about.
Yeah, and I'm glad to hear you say that. I want you to take us behind the scenes. You were a chief negotiator on the NAFTA deal. I was a much younger man when that agreement took place. My recollection of it was that was a much more collaborative effort by the three countries, where this one feels like, boy, it was really in your face along the way. President Trump was tweeting some pretty nasty stuff, both about Mexico and Canada, in an effort to bring them to the table, I think. It looks like it worked. What was the atmosphere like when you were negotiating NAFTA? Was it as much adversarial, or was it as collaborative as my memory recalls?
There were certainly some very collaborative parts of the original NAFTA, especially with the Mexicans, interestingly, and that was in large part because we had a gigantic geopolitical shift in the world at that time. The wall had come down, and Mexico, which was essentially a satellite state of the Soviet Union, was cast adrift, so they were really looking for friends. The Canadians had to give up a little bit to do the NAFTA, but they got a little bit, so they were interested but not as committed to it as the Mexicans. And I think the difference this time is that both Mexico and Canada had to make some concessions. And so President Trump felt like it was necessary for him to be, as you say, very aggressive and even acerbic at times in prompting them to come along.
How long did that NAFTA negotiation take, Alan?
The original one was less than 12 months from the moment President Bush, 41, the first President Bush, said, let's take advantage of the fact that Mexico is no longer a satellite nation of the Soviet Union and bring them into a free trade agreement, to the time that they had signed the agreement in the Rose Garden was less than 12 months.
Let's go back again. I want to sort of talk a little bit more about China, given that we have the meeting at the G20 later this week. Right now, as I take it, we've imposed some tariffs on Chinese goods. The Chinese have responded by imposing tariffs on things like soybeans. And what are some of the other major sort of responses they've had, Alan?
Well, the Chinese have threatened to put a lot more tariffs on a lot more goods, although they have found that there are some things they really don't want to impose tariffs on because they need those U.S. products. Some of it's agriculture, some of it's oil or oil products, refined products. I think that that's going to be a fairly contentious discussion at the G20 because the Chinese are not quick to change. Trump is asking for big changes, and he's not likely to get them as fast as this coming week.
So what happens next? I'm asking you to look in your crystal ball.
Yeah, I had a crystal ball. They gave me one when they made me the head of the trade remedy laws, and I still haven't seen anything in that ball, but I keep it nearby in case it does start revealing the truth. What I think is likely is that there'll be some sort of compromise, and the negotiations will go on. It's possible that the U.S. and the Chinese will just declare victory and go home, which is more of a status quo result. But the least desirable outcome is that we do get into an exchange of tariffs, an increasing exchange of tariffs imposed against each other. And that's just putting the brakes on the entire world economy. It's tapping the brakes. It's not jamming them on, but it's not good. We found that economic growth is one of the most desirable things the government can do for us. And if our two governments get involved in tapping the brakes, that doesn't help either country.
And Alan, what are some things that you're looking for to guide your thinking, whether the tapping the brakes outcome is more likely to happen or both parties going home and declaring victory?
Well, each administration is a little bit of a puzzle on its own right. This one is at least as puzzling as most. I'm not certain that I can tell you whether they're going to find a way out of the thicket or whether we're going to get into an exchange of tariffs.
I kind of like your declare victory and go home. Is that's not all that dissimilar than what happened with NAFTA, is it?
Yeah, I think they took some marbles with them and when they went home, so there was some improvement, as I say, even if it wasn't dramatic. It was important to some, and that's sufficient. Clearly, that was sufficient to declare victory. I think that the Chinese could find a concession that would make it easy for the president to save face in the Asian way and declare victory, and I think that we could probably find some ways to make Xi Jinping look good, too.
Alan, we've spent a lot of time on China. There's several different folks, countries that we have trade disputes with. What about Europe? How is the challenge with Europe different than China? And are there some strategies that you think the U.S. should employ to make it more likely to have a successful outcome?
So there's less non-tariff barriers with Europe. What we have done in the European-U.S. relationship is pretty much tariffy, as we call it, the various trade barriers so that we can put a real number on it. We're not pushing each other's cars off the docks. We're not using sort of non-tariff ways to restrict trade anywhere near the same as is the case with China. So in that sense, it's a better relationship because we understand each other and we know what we're doing. But the Europeans have a whole lot more tariffs on U.S. imports than the U.S. has on European imports, and that needs to be understood. It's at several levels. It is a dramatic difference. It is well over 10% if you include the VAT rebates, the value-added tax rebates that Europe grants and that we are not allowed to grant after a trade dispute we had with Europe on this some years ago. Stu Eisenstadt was in charge of that dispute, and I'm sure he would, if you brought him on, he'd describe that as a very frustrating experience. Basically, what Trump is trying to do is get the tariffs more equalized between Europe and the U.S.
Okay, Alan, unfortunately, we just have time for one last question. And based on how you're talking about Europe, I think a lot of listeners, myself included, are asking, how did we get here? How did we allow that imbalance with Europe to take place?
Well, Roger's right. It's a complex question, and it goes back to the end of World War II. We really did give the Europeans a tremendous reconstruction boost with our trade policies, and we never really corrected that once they became in every way our economic equal. So some of that is really just hangover from World War II, believe it or not, and some of it is because they have their own internal politics that make them somewhat protectionist internally as well as externally to other non-EU countries like us. It's a long problem to unwind.
I have a last question after the last question, which is about TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What was that about and where do we stand?
It was a larger version of the NAFTA. It had some very good proposals that were part of it and that are being adopted by a number of countries. In fact, it's going into effect at the end of this year among the countries that remain participants. Of course, the U.S. is not one of them.
We've been talking to Alan Dunn, former Assistant Secretary of Commerce, who's been enlightening us on the complex issue of international trade. Alan, thanks for spending time with us. Mountain Money will be right back after this.
Hi, this is Steve Roney, owner of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. I'm a proud resident of Park City and a loyal supporter of KPCW and all it does for our community. Our agents in Summit and Wasatch counties can be reached at any of our 30 offices or at our website, bhhsutah.com.
Hi, this is Kevin Holliday, bike buyer for Jan's, supporting KPCW. Jan's Bike Shop is open year-round for sales and service. We offer bikes from Trek, Scott, and Santa Cruz. Bike apparel from Gore, Bontrager, and Club Rod. Available at our flagship store on Park Avenue, 649-4949 or jans.com.
Hi, I'm Tony Tyler with Columbus Pacific Development, a proud sponsor of KPCW. Viridian Residences, located on the 11th hole of the Canyons Golf Course, offers 24 contemporary townhomes and 2 to 5 bedroom floor plans. Information about Viridian can be found online at viridianparkcity.com.
Welcome back to Mound Money. fascinating conversation about trade law and tariffs. And now we're going to switch gears. We're going to talk about a national business that is opening up here locally. We've got Greg Elder. He is the vice president of retail for L.L. Bean. And they are opening up a new location on Main Street, 670 Main Street. Greg, thank you for joining us on Mound Money.
Thanks for having me. On the heels of trade laws and tariffs, too.
Well, this will be a lighter conversation and hopefully enjoyable as well. So I've enjoyed getting the L.L. Bean catalog in my mailbox probably for four decades. But now I'm going to be able to walk down the street and actually go visit a store. So first off, welcome to Utah.
Yeah, we're excited. It's our furthest west venture. We opened a store in Denver, Colorado a few years ago, but this was just such an exciting opportunity to enter Utah, and we're thrilled to be there.
And how did Park City get on L.L. Bean's radar screen?
Well, it was the city is, we've got a really loyal customer base in Salt Lake City and subsequently in Park City as well. So we're fairly well known out there, but it was really the combination of the location that became available on the corner of Heber and Main, coupled with just the active outdoor lifestyle that people in Park City live, and our desire to want to try a new, smaller format store in the kind of area like Park City that has a ton of abundant outdoor natural resources, people that enjoy getting out in them, as well as you know, a fair amount of people they're going to be visiting. So it's kind of the combination of those factors that presented it as kind of an opportunity that we couldn't resist.
You know, as a finance show, we're always interested in how business decisions are made. Did you guys actually sit down and look at how many purchases were made in our local zip codes as part of your decision to open up here?
Yeah, that always has a bearing on it. You know, certainly how well do we do with the catalog and the website and how many buyers and customers do we have in the area is certainly one thing. But then there's also the potential of, you know, how many outdoor enthusiasts live there that potentially don't know the brand or haven't shopped with us. So it's a combination of again, those things, people that know us and love us, and the opportunity to present the brand to people that either don't know us or have misconceptions of us.
Well, Greg, since you opened the door, let me let you walk through it and talk to us about the brand. I want to preface it by saying, as I said earlier, we've gotten your catalog for many, many years. My daughter, a couple years ago, when she was 13 years old, was spending her own money on a book bag and was debating to get one of the cheap ones that you can buy anywhere for $10 or get one of the quality ones. I think you guys were $90 or $100 for the book bag. And one of the things I told her is if she bought it from L.L. Bean, she'd have a book bag for the rest of her life. Why is that? Tell us about your products and tell us about your guarantees and how you stand behind the products you sell.
Well, that's an interesting point. I mean, for years, I mean, since we were founded by L.L. himself, we've always been recognized and applauded and kind of awarded for our legendary customer service, and that holds true over 100 years later. At the cornerstone of that, one of the things I would say that's been at the cornerstone is our legendary guarantee. And we recently changed it, actually, coming back into February. Unfortunately, the guarantee had been misinterpreted as a lifetime guarantee, and that was never LL's purpose nor our intent or desire. So we made some changes this year to make it a one-year guarantee, and you know, we still stand behind all of our products, and 1 year is certainly still very, very, very generous. But that was a change that we made this year. Fortunately, the vast majority of customers certainly understood the rationale for that change, and you know, regretfully, there was just so many. There was a minority of people, I should say, that were kind of exercising that guarantee beyond any way that any reasonable person would. So, it really was the catalyst for us doing something to kind of bring it back to its original intent. So, I don't know if that answers your question, but that was certainly a tangent to your question for sure.
You described the new store, which, as I understand it, is 6,400 square feet in the what used to be the Kimball Arts Building, which has now been completely remodeled. And you described that as a smaller store. What does a typical L.L. Bean store look like, and how is the smaller size changing what you're going to be able to stock?
Yeah, great question. Typical, we've got two primary formats out there, a 30,000 square foot and a 15,000 square foot, and that's the size that we've been opening most prominently. This year, we made the decision to try three less than 10,000 square foot stores, and we opened one in the Boston Seaport District, one in New Haven, Connecticut, right on the Yale campus, and then most recently, our Park City store. And really what it does is it was an exciting ability for us to really curate the assortment down to say, what is the stuff that the active outdoor family enthusiast really needs? So we needed to make a lot of hard choices and curate the assortment down to the things that we believe represent the best of the best items, both in footwear, equipment, outerwear, and gear, down to that footprint. So it was really fun because you really needed to make some hard choices and take out some of the items that, you know, may be redundant or superfluous and really get to the core of, you know, what someone needs to enjoy the outdoors in Park City and the surrounding areas. And I think we did a really good job of reflecting that in Park City.
I'm excited to check it out and see the store. I haven't been there yet. We've talked about your product. We've talked about your brand. Let's talk about your team. And one of the notorious challenges for retailers in Park City is just hiring the amount of people that they need and getting the quality that they need. There's a lot of competition for higher skilled retail labor. How have you guys navigated that here in Park City?
Well, we really wanted to hire someone from the local community, and we were really fortunate to find an amazing store manager, someone that's been in the community for quite some time and is very well connected to the community. So that was step one. We had one internal transfer, somebody that came from one of our stores back east, and then at the sales representative level, the amount of talent that turned out at our job fairs and recruiting sites just absolutely blew us away. You know, we expected there to be a fairly good turnout, but it was the quality of the people that really just was just overwhelming. And the amount of experience that people had, you know, again, as you'd expect being from Park City, you know, runners and bikers and paddlers and fly fishers and, you know, kind of every sport that we support, people came out with just tremendous experience in. So it was pretty neat to see people that you know, partake in these outdoor pursuits, really wanting to be part of bringing the brand out west, and they showed up in really good numbers. And the decisions around who to select was pretty challenging, but the team that we landed on, both in terms of quantity and quality, was just absolutely blew me away.
We've talked at a high level about your product lines. How would you break down the inventory that you're going to keep in terms of categories, in terms of shoes versus indoor clothes versus outdoor clothes? And I don't know what kind of breakdown you would use.
Yeah, we kind of look at our product across you know, four categories. The first being active, the second being casual, the third being rugged, and the last being refined. And I would say the mix here on the, when you enter the store, you'll come right into women's active, casual, and rugged apparel. We've got a fairly significant men's and women's footwear assortment on the first floor as well. Then you go up a couple of stairs and you'll go onto the men's line as you go back towards the rear of the store. Downstairs is predominantly equipment and outerwear. So this time of year, you'll have a curated assortment of snowshoes, men's and women, and some children's outerwear. and will also carry hiking, camping, and fly fishing year-round. So it's divided across the two floors that way. In terms of the curation of the assortment, some of our more refined styles, we opted not to assort into the store. So some of, think khaki pants and wrinkle-resistant sport shirts, things, of that nature, which are great sellers for L.L. Bean, just didn't fit within kind of the outdoor ethos of Park City. So we opted to edit those out in favor of more equipment and active apparel and outerwear.
So we have some of these staples that all of us have in our closets, and we occasionally need to update them and styles change. But what about new technology, new fabrics? Is there another Gore-Tex on the horizon that we should all know about?
Oh, there's all sorts of innovations that are happening out there, both in equipment and apparel. Where do I start? on the apparel side of life, we're seeing, performance fabrications, stretch, water repellency, reflectivity, microfibers, all of those things becoming more and more prevalent as the customer's looking for durability and functionality. Seeing a lot of innovation, technical innovation with outerwear as well. We now have, water-resistant down jackets. We've got micropuff and nanopuff that provide unbelievable amounts of insulation at very light weights and packability. So, really across all of our merchant categories, from equipment to outerwear to apparel to fashion apparel, the industry and fibers and fills have just come so far in recent years that it's really a cool time to be both a designer and a consumer, quite frankly.
I guess the outerwear thing really interests me because we've seen, 5 years ago, the down jacket was a big puffy coat. And I take it that now you can actually produce the same kind of warmth with a much thinner, smaller jacket. Is that right?
Yeah. Both with natural down as well as some of the new PrimaLoft technology, one of our best-selling jackets is our 850 down, and the 850 stands for the quality of down, or in essence, what the amount of cubic centimeters that an ounce of that down would fill. So the higher the fill power, the loftier the down, and the more insulating properties that it has. So warmth is really a byproduct of the fill power of the down, the amount of fill weight of that down that goes into the garment, and then how is it stitched? Is it stitched through the down, or is it baffle stitched or box stitched? So it's a combination of those factors that enable us to produce a very lightweight down sweater jacket, for example, that has tremendous insulating properties, and as I said previously, and now with water repellency, it's just amazing how the technology has evolved.
Well, lots of fascinating things to look forward to. We look forward to visiting your store, and welcome here to Utah. Our guest has been Greg Elder. He is the Vice President of Retail for L.L. Bean. Greg, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for the time, and look forward to seeing you out there when I'm in town next.
Awesome. Thanks again. And stay tuned to Mound Money. Up next, we've got a conversation with the folks from Consumer Reports talking to us about things we need to look out for when we think we're getting a great deal for holiday shopping. Mound Money returns after this short break.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Hi, this is Whitney Ryan from Park City Mountain and proud supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise recently committed to a net zero footprint by 2030. The environment is our business. By 2030, we commit to zero net emissions, zero waste to the landfill, and a zero net operating impact to forests and habitat. More information at epicpromise.com.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. We're going to switch gears and begin our holiday theming of this show as well as other shows on KPCW. Our guest is currently is Toby Stanger. He is the senior money writer for Consumer Reports, and they have written an article on helping you think through, are you really getting the best deal on these online sales? Toby, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So, Toby, share with us what the main theme of the article is. Why are people perhaps not getting the deal they think they are?
Well, people see the word sale, and of course that gets them all excited, and there's a psychological component that leads people to be attracted to that when maybe it's not really the best price. So our main theme is don't just look at the word sale. You can do many things to protect yourself and to make sure that you get the best price for what you're looking for over the holiday season.
What interested me in the article was the discussion of how there had actually been analytics done of major retailers who had claimed that they were making a sale or a discount that didn't really, in fact, check out when you went and did the analysis. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so Consumer Reports is a not-for-profit. There's another not-for-profit named Consumer Tech Book that does some related stuff to what we do, and they did an analysis that found that in 19 national retailers, there were a few chains, JCPenney, Kmart, Kohl's, Macy's, Neiman Marcus, Sears, where most of the items were offered at a discount every week. So what was a sale really wasn't a sale. And they did find that there were two retailers. Sorry?
You're okay. Please keep going.
I'm sorry. I'm getting an echo. So there were two retailers that we did find that they did find really did have legitimate sales. One was Bed Bath & Beyond, and the other was Costco. But the point is, just because it says it's a sale doesn't necessarily mean it's a sale. The stores manipulate that wording quite a bit.
And what you found was that they would post a regular price and a discounted price, but that nobody actually, it's the classic syllogism, nobody actually ever paid retail. In other words, the stated price was never really, really used.
That's right. In many cases, the stated price was the base price, the anchor price, was actually the not as often on the tag as the sale price. So the sale price was more frequently used than the anchor price. So in that case, you know, what really is a sale? And the point to consumers is don't look at the word sale. Look at the prices, track the prices. And that's easier than ever to do in this day and age where there's lots of electronic help to help you do that.
Well, I want to talk about that, how consumers can do that. But first, I want to kind of lay the landscape and share a little bit of the information you have in this article as far as the scope of this challenge and the impact of putting original pricing that, as Roger says, nobody ever pays retail. So is that really original pricing? And companies have paid big fines. Neiman Marcus paid a $2.9 million fine for that practice. Amazon paid over $1 million in Canada. And we have a company here locally called Overstock.com, and they were also fined for this practice. So it is legitimate. It is an issue. We are talking big dollars. So what can consumers do to protect themselves? What are some resources that they can use to get a better idea of what whether something's actually a good sale or not?
Well, the main thing is too, if there are items you really want this holiday season, start tracking them now. You can track them with various apps. There are some apps there are browser extensions such as there's one called Invisible Hand, Price Blink, there's something called the Camelizer, as in the animal, the camel, and these will scour the web for discounts and coupons and deals to bring you the best prices every time you shop. There are also apps. There's another one called Camel, Camel, Camel. I don't know what it is about camels. Or maybe they're great shoppers. And Price Tracker, Shop It To Me, Slick Deals. You enter items that you're searching for in these apps, and they will let you know when the prices for the items have dropped. And then there are other apps that do price comparisons. So there's a lot on consumerreports.org that you can see to help you search for those best prices.
Let me ask you to take a step back. What's a browser extension?
It's something, it sort of works in the background of the browser. So you're not, it will pop up, it will give you, it's not something that you're going to be seeing all the time. But when they find something for you, they'll let you know that it's sort of working off of your browser. So it's really for your laptop or your desktop computer. It's not an app that you download and you have running, you know, you click to it and run on your phone. But it will do the same kind of shopping for you on a regular basis.
Yeah, and I'll share with our listeners. I use one of those browser extensions, and it's really easy. If there's a better price, it just pops up and says, hey, there's a better price somewhere else. So it's definitely worth exploring. Your article, which I should tell our listeners, appears in the December 2018 version of Consumer Reports magazine, which is on bookstore shelves now or in the grocery stores, wherever people buy magazines. Your article lists a couple of the common strategies that retailers use where we want to be careful. And I want to go through a couple of those. The first is doorbuster deals. We're all going to start seeing those in the flyers in our newspaper this week. What are some of the cautions consumers should know with doorbuster deals?
Yeah, so be aware, first of all, that the doorbuster deal may only be for a very short period of time. There may be a limited amount of it. And, of course, you know, when do you have to get there? You know, do you have to get there at 6 a.m.? And, you know, be aware that the doorbuster is sort of a loss leader for the company. That gets you in the door physically. And once you're there, you will be probably tempted to look around a little bit more. And you'll see items for sale that might tempt you, but they may not really be on sale or they may not really be a good deal. So the doorbuster is an enticing device that can backfire if you're not very disciplined.
And the next one you discuss is the buy one, get one free, or BOGO. Can you describe what the concern is
there? Yeah. Yeah, they actually call it BOGO. So it's really, the discount may not be as big as you think it is. It may be that you get one for, you buy two, you know, purchase two on a buy one, you get one for 50% off, and the sale will actually, you'll only really end up getting a 25% discount when all is said and done. It's, it's not necessarily, you have to do the math, because it's not necessarily what you think it's going to be. They may have raised the price on that item in order to give you this buy one, get one free, and so it's really not going to help you.
That was my next question. Do you have to do the same kind of price comparison that we were talking about before to understand whether or not you're in fact getting a bargain?
Absolutely, and that's why, you know, smartphones are great. You've got a calculator right there, but also tracking things that you're really interested in. We thought a really great idea that we saw Consumer Reports has seen is, if there's something you're interested in online, you can shop for it in the online and just leave it in your cart. Don't necessarily buy it right away. The algorithms of the company will realize you haven't moved on that item, and a couple of days later, you can come back, and if it's still in your shopping cart, you might find that the company has given you a discount because it really wants you to click that button and purchase.
Just joining us, our guest is Toby Stranger. She's a senior money writer with Consumer Reports. Her article appears, it's actually the cover story of the current version of Consumer Reports, December 2018. And the headline on the magazine is How to Know Which Deals Are Real. And that's what we're talking about, is how to protect ourselves. And on the topic of protecting ourselves, one of the long-term concerns I have, Toby, you mentioned algorithms and how these online retailers have so much information on us. I think people will be shocked to hear that Amazon.com on online Black Friday sales, they do over 50% of the online transactions for all online retailers in the United States, which is just a crazy number. And the number is actually much higher than 50%, but I'm quite confident it's over 50%. Toby, what's your thoughts on that? Do consumers need to be worried at the savviness of the algorithms? Is that something that helps us, or is that something we have to be cautious about?
Both. As I mentioned, one of the tricks is, and Amazon will do this, you know, leaving stuff in your cart and waiting for Amazon to come to you and say, okay, we lowered your price. But you're right, it can work against you. If we have found in the past that, you know, if Amazon realizes you're in a certain zip code, they may realize, hey, you know what, this person can afford more. Or it may just see your buying patterns over time and say, you know, we don't have to reduce our price that much for this person. So, you know, it may be worth shopping on someone else's account. It may be worth going in as a guest and not as, you know, not signing in. That also makes sure with retailers that they're not collecting more information from you. There are different tactics that you can use to make sure it's not collecting the information, and it can also possibly lead to better deals. It's, you know, they're very smart, these algorithms, but, you know, you could try, for example, ordering, if you're in one part of the country and you want something to go to another part of the country, maybe you have it ordered from somebody in that side of the country, and maybe the deal is better on at that end. I mean, things, you know, there's all sorts of geographic things that they can do. It's pretty crazy.
A couple other items that you touch on in the article that I wanted to quickly discuss. One was going out of business sales. Now, if I see one of those at a Sears or a Kmart, I'd probably believe it this year. But in general, you raised some skepticism about those.
Yeah, going out of business doesn't mean what you think it means. I mean, they can, you know, stores can have more than one going out of business sale in their life of the store. So be cautious about that. And it, you know, it could be a good sale, but it doesn't mean that they're necessarily, you're not going to see them anymore in that location.
Well, we're all going out of business at some point. I was back in Cleveland, Ohio to visit my 84-year-old mother a couple weeks ago. And as a child, there was a local retailer that was going out of business. It was a furniture store. And you know what? 50 years later, it's still going out of business. Toby,
well,
we thank
you. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, Toby, we thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Yeah. Thanks very much. Take care. Bye-bye.
Our guest today has been Toby Stranger, senior money writer with Consumer Reports. She's written the cover story for the current December issue of Consumer Reports, How to Know Which Deals Are Real. Please stay tuned to Mountain Money. We'll be back in a moment to wrap up.
Hi, I'm Chris Hadley of Jones Waldo's Park City office. Jones Waldo has been serving our great state since 1875 and supporting this great station since 2007. Jones Waldo provides legal counsel to our local, regional, and national clients in areas such as real estate, corporate, intellectual property, and more. We are located in Kimball Junction and at joneswaldo.com.
Joining the Park City Chamber Bureau is an inexpensive and smart investment for your business. Chamber Bureau members receive private access to advertising opportunities, referrals, educational and professional seminars, business-to-business events, and other exclusive resources to help businesses grow. The Park City Chamber Bureau supports over 1,000 area businesses, both large and small. More info at visitparkcity.com or 649-6100. The Park City Chamber Bureau is a nonprofit organization and a proud supporter of KPCW.
Welcome back to Mountain Money. You know, Doug, one of the things you just touched on was what consumers should be worried about in protecting themselves when they're shopping online. And that's a good segue to next week's program, when we will have, on Cyber Monday, as you are sitting and buying your cyber gifts, we will have a cybersecurity expert, Jennifer Archie, who will talk to us about privacy and cybersecurity as we go into the holiday season.
Yeah, you have to be careful when you're online. And one of the things, Roger, this is the season for being grateful, and we here at KPCW and Mound Money are certainly grateful for many things, this great community, our great listeners, and also our great sponsors. And the sponsors for Mound Money, they include Mound West Bank, Jan's Mountain Outfitters, Park City Chamber Bureau, Jones Waldo, Holbrook and McDonough, Columbus Pacific Development with Viridian and Apex Residences, San Francisco Design, and Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties.
Our guest today, which we also have to thank, was Alan Dunn, the former Assistant Secretary of Commerce, Greg Elder from L.L. Bean, and Toby Stanger from Consumer Reports. Interesting that as we were talking to Alan about the impact of tariffs, the market was reacting. It's down about 370, and some of the stories are indicating that's partly in insecurity about relationships with China on trade.
Yeah, you know, that's been a common theme so far this year. That's an overhang. Also, uncertainty over interest rates. It certainly looks like interest rates are going to climb. And what that means to us is more tapping on the brakes, to use Alan's analogy, for the economy. And really what you want to do is have a long-term investment strategy. Stick to it. There's going to be ups and downs along the way. Speaking of ups and downs and twists and turns, it looks like we've got snow in the forecast for later this week. We are a ski town, so I hope the people here in Park City go out there and enjoy that. Stay tuned to KPCW. NPR News is next. This is KPCW.